Good afternoon, everybody. This is James Martinez for another edition of Cashflow here on Achieve Power Hits Network. I just want to thank everybody for being queued up for this interview today. I just want to begin, let everybody know our special guest today is John Perkins, author of Hoodwinked, and also probably that you've heard before, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I got to tell you, preface this before I bring him on here for today, is that many, many years ago, I was actually in the jungles of South America, in Lima and Brujai and Iquitos, and working with some of the shamans down in that area of the world. And during that time, a copy of his book actually showed up in the midst of what I was doing there. And at that time, I was going head-to-head with all the credit card companies and figuring out ways of helping people deal with that issue there. But I got to tell you, if there's a guy that's ever been on the inside of what's really going on in the financial world at the very top levels of the world, this is the guy. This is his book, Confessions of an Economic Man, was an international, it's a bestseller. John Perkins had the official title of chief economist at a major international consulting firm during the 1970s. He also advised the World Bank, United Nations, International Monetary Fund, U.S. Treasury Department, Fortune 500 corporations, and countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Middle East. In his role as economic hitman, he worked directly with heads of state, CEOs of major companies to promote and develop the types of projects described in Hoodwinked and Confessions of an Economic Hitman. His new book, by the way, is Hoodwinked, available on Amazon.com. It's also available on his website, johnperkins.org. During the 1980s, he was CEO of an alternative energy company that was a pioneer in developing environmentally beneficial power plants. He devoted much of his time in the 1990s and 2000s not only to writing and lecturing, but also to establishing and supporting Dream Change, the Pachamama Alliance, and other nonprofit organizations that are committed to creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. My special guest today is John Perkins. John Perkins, welcome aboard.
Thanks, James. That was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it. It's good to be with you.
So yeah, it's so interesting because I was actually in South America when I got a first copy of your book, and I said, someday I'm going to have to get this guy on to talk about what happens in the inner workings of at the highest levels of banking. Now, for a lot of people, because of what's going on with the banking and the corporations, a lot of people are just waking up to this whole concept of what's happened. I recently just got off the phone this morning with actually David Cobb, who was the presidential nominee in 2004 for the Green Party, who told me to say hello to you, by the way, and totally agrees with everything that you're saying. But let's just go back. When and how did you get involved with it? When you were an economic hitman, when did that start? And did you know that that was your job? I mean, because you've totally changed from the dark side to the other side, which I think is great, by the way. How did it all start for you?
Well, it started when I was in business school in Boston in the late 60s. I was recruited by the National Security Agency and went through a series of tests, personality tests, lie detector tests, the whole works. And they kind of identified me as a potentially good economic hitman, based a con artist who had been to business school, and they also identified a few traits that made it easy to hook me. I talk about those pretty extensively in the book. I think, you know, those are perhaps the three big drugs of our culture: the desire to have money, power, and sex. Mm-hmm. I had them all. I was a very young man, and they identified these. Then I went off to the Peace Corps for 3 years, and I worked in the Amazon and Andes, which gave me an interesting perspective. I think they saw it as training for my future job, but in the end, I think in a way it's what convinced me to get out. But after the Peace Corps, they recruited me to work for a private consulting firm in Boston, a company of about 2,000 employees, Charles T. Maine. I was an economist. I became chief economist. But I was trained by this woman named Claudine, who I describe in detail in the books, a pretty amazing woman, very clever, very intelligent, very seductive. She knew all my weaknesses and used them extensively. And she also explained to me what I would be called upon to do as an economic hitman. And she was pretty clear about the fact that once in, you'd never get out, and this is what I was going to do, and it was a dirty business. But I didn't quite fall for it. I thought, you know, like so many of us, that I would be the exception. I would get the inside story and expose the whole system, which, of course, eventually I did, but it took me a long time. So she got the hooks in me and then sent me off to Indonesia, and I began having a good time doing what I was doing, and it got increasingly difficult for me to get out.
Now, when you say they got their hooks into you, are there a lot of people that are economic hitmen such as yourself that get into that position and then figure out, okay, I don't want to do this anymore, and they're stuck in it and they can't get out? Is that what you mean? Like, they compromise your freedom and say, no, now that you know what we're in, you got to stay in? Or how does it work?
Well, you know, once I decided to get out, after I'd been in for 10 years, I perhaps made the mistake of deciding I was going to write about this, and I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals. And jackals are the people that, when we economic hitmen fail, the jackals go in. Well, we fail to corrupt. If we fail to corrupt presidents of countries, get them to buy into this game, which we seldom do fail, but when we do, the jackals go in and either assassinate those presidents or leaders or overthrow them. Because I failed in Ecuador with President of Ecuador, Jaime Roldos, and in Panama with Omar Torrijos, they were both assassinated because I was unable to corrupt them, to get them to come around. About that same time that they were assassinated, I decided I had to get out. And I was quiet for a while, but then I started writing this book, and I contacted other economic hitmen and jackals to get their stories. And then very soon, I received anonymous phone calls, threats on my life. And I had a young daughter. She was born in 82. They made threats on her life. At the same time, another big consulting firm out of Boston, Stone & Webster, the chairman of the board, took me out to dinner. And he told me, you know, you've got a great resume. I did. I've been chief economist at a major consulting firm. We'd like to use your resume in proposals. We won't ask you to do any work. We just want to use your resume, and we'll pay you a consultant's retainer of about $500,000, but you mustn't write the book I know you've been working on. And I'll tell you, I was, James, you know, sufficiently frightened by the threats. I'd seen what these people could do, and the bribe was there. It was a legal bribe. There was nothing illegal about it. I took it. And I have to say, in my own self-defense, that I put a lot of the money toward good causes, toward creating nonprofits. They were working in the Amazon, Andes, many other places with these people. You can go to dreamchange.org or Pachamama.org and see some of the nonprofits I created. But I didn't write the book. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot. That's typical. People out there that are doing this work, if they decide to get out, either have to be totally quiet about it, or finally, when I did write the book, after 9/11, I was in the Amazon on 9/11. But afterwards, I went up to Ground Zero, stood there at that smoldering pit, and realized I finally had to write this book. But this time, I decided I wouldn't tell a soul. I'd write the whole book, not a proposal, the whole book. Nobody would know. I wouldn't contact anybody. Get it in the hands of my agent and out into all the major publishing houses. And at that point, it became my best insurance policy. So, you know, if you're going to be a whistleblower, I recommend it. Blowing a whistle is a cathartic experience and important in our culture. But don't threaten to do it. Don't tell anybody you're going to do it ahead of time. Just do it and have all your ducks in order. Have all your research lined up. Have everything there and get it out into the public eye real fast, because then the jackals know they can't, you know, there's no point in assassinating you or doing anything bad to you, because it's just going to generate more interest in the book.
You know, I hear this, and I know a lot of people are listening to this right now in many different countries as well as the U.S., and some of this that the banks do from the top down and that you were involved with, they just can't believe it. The denial level here in the U.S. is it's so intense, but it's starting to wake up now. I mean, as you've because of all the stuff that's happened with the banks and the crash and everything else, I mean, I'm presuming that audiences now are starting to really pay attention to what you said and hoodwinked as you go around on speaking engagements. But what are people's major questions that they aim at you when you're speaking at colleges or conferences or things of that nature? What do they ask you?
Well, they asked me a lot about the details of exactly what I did in Ecuador and Saudi Arabia and Indonesia and Iran and many of the other places where I worked. What I'm finding increasingly is that at least in the audience, the questions I'm getting and the big audiences that are coming to hear me in major universities, MBA programs, I even speak at corporate conferences these days, is I'm not finding people, anybody that's not believing me. It, when the book first came out, there was some skepticism, perhaps. But I think, you know,
think we lost our connection with John there. I think he was talking on a cell phone. We'll try and get him back. I think he disconnected there. Hopefully we can get him back.
I can hear you.
Oh, there you are. Okay, all right. I couldn't hear you. Go ahead.
I can hear you fine, and I'm not on a cell phone. I'm on a landline. Where did you lose me?
Okay.
What are they saying?
Okay, you were just about talking about that everybody in your audience does believe you, whereas before they were a little bit,
Yeah, I think, you know, in recent years there have been a lot of books. David Corden, a lot of people have written books. There have been a lot of movies, Blood Diamond, Constant Gardner, the Al Gore movie. I mean, there's been so much going on. And I'm really finding a shift in attitude. I think this current global crisis, I think the war in Iraq, the never-ending war in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think there's so many things that are getting people to really understand the Enron and Anderson cases. I mean, there's so much that's gone on, James, since Confessions came out in late 2004. And in fact, when I go to universities, which I do a lot, I ask to have dinner with 20 to 30 students before I speak, and I ask them to tell me why they're having dinner with me, why they're at this university, what are their aspirations. Back in 2005, they were saying, I'm talking particularly about ones in MBA programs, Wharton, Stanford, Cornell, these kinds of programs. They were all talking about wanting more money and power. This last year, I don't hear that at all. I hear kids talking about wanting to do good in the world, wanting to create a greener world. I think they're beginning to understand that the only way their children can have a good world, the only way their children can hope to have homeland security, let's say, is to recognize mm-hmm. that the whole world is our homeland, and that this business of trying to exploit people in Africa or South America or elsewhere just isn't working. We're way too small a planet today. We're all too interdependent. We've got to make this a better home for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Hey, I'm that's music to my ears. You have no idea. But here's my main question, because I actually had contacts before I started to go head to head with the credit card company. I had contacts at the World Bank, and I had contacts at IMF from actual relatives that I knew that worked there. And I started, and one of my main questions is, since you were on the inside, what is the because when I was speaking to people down in South America where you were, they think these people at the high levels of the banks are mentally ill, like there's something wrong inside of them that they would even consider coming in and doing this to certain countries. What's the mental attitude? Is it strictly, we need to profit and we don't care what we do? Or what is going on in their head? That's what I want to know.
Well, I think a certain number of them are psychopaths or sociopaths, if you want to say that, people that don't have a conscience, really, that don't know anything about guilt. But I think it's also fair to say that they're very shrewd, that they're the same. They have a mentality that's similar to empire builders throughout history of just wanting more power, more money, more resources. And this is the way they're doing it today. This is truly the world's first global empire. It's truly mm-hmm. global. And the first one in history that's been built primarily without the military through just economic subterfuge, so the type of things that I did, and they've been very successful. So why would they do this? Because they're successful, because they're people that want to go out and basically grab the world, to clutch it, very much the way medieval kings did and throughout history. Robber barons and dictators have been driven by this amazing desire to become rich and powerful, and these people are very successful at it. It's just that this time around, it's more subtle, more clandestine. Many people in the United States don't realize that this empire building has been going on. We see the United States as this country that favors democracy and freedom, and it just unfortunately isn't true. I mean, we the people I think favor those things. I believe in those things. It's why I write the books, because I think the United States and, in fact, the world has been stolen by these robber barons. I want to get it back. The only way we're going to get it back is to understand what's happened and then to dig in and fight to get it back. We're going to have to get it back. We've got to get it back for the sake of our children and ourselves and what we really deeply believe in.
Mm-hmm. What would you suggest for listeners? Because I've had all sorts of guests talk about these various things with what the corporations or banks are doing. What would you suggest? I mean, you know, because you've been on the inside and how they think and what type of action needs to be taken out by the public to deal with this.
Well, my book, Hoodwink, the most recent book, is devoted to that. And, you know, I can't go into the kind of detail on the air that I can in the book. So, first of all, I suggest people buy the book, not just because I want to sell the book, but because it really is a blueprint for what to do. But But to summarize, you know, there's five areas I talk about in that book, and in each one of them we can all participate, and there's many sub-areas within each of those five areas where we all have power. We, the people, really have the power. And I think most important is to recognize that these big corporations are vulnerable, that they run the world, first of all. It's not the president. We've seen that the president of the United States doesn't really have that much power. He's very, very controlled by corporations. He's also very vulnerable. Just like any president anywhere, he's vulnerable. He's vulnerable to assassination, physical assassination, and he's vulnerable to character assassination, which is what we saw happen to Clinton with Monica Lewinsky. Presidents just don't have that much power, and they get into power because corporations provide their war chest, their financial war chest. So once they're in power, they have to cede to the corporations is what exactly we're seeing. So we the people have to do it, and in fact, we've always had to do it. We didn't get rid of slavery because Abraham Lincoln suddenly found himself in the White House. We got rid of slavery because we voted in a man who was committed to getting rid of slavery. Women didn't get the right to vote because Woodrow Wilson was pro-suffrage. He wasn't. They got the right to vote because once he was elected, they followed him around, and they carried placards, and they demonstrated as he went around the country trying to drum up support for sending our troops to Europe to defend democracy in Europe. The women screamed, you know, we're not sending our men off to defend democracy in Europe. We don't have democracy here. Half of us, all of us women, can't vote. Half the population of the United States can't vote. And Wilson finally got the message. You know, we got out of Vietnam because we the people demanded it. It's always been we the people. And we get to recognize that, James, and get out there and realize that the vulnerable spot now and the power spot is the big corporations. And they're totally dependent on us. If we don't buy their goods and services, they don't make it. That's right. A fact. And
exactly.
We have tremendous, yeah. And you know, the marketplace is democratic if we choose to make it such. So when we vote, when we buy something or don't buy something, we're casting a vote.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this all over the place. What's your take on the BP situation? I mean, it's just, I just like, every time I see that situation, I'm just like, what in the, how could this possibly be happening, and who's profiting, and what's really going on there? What's your take on that?
Well, it's of course a terrible disaster, and I think one of the things we have to recognize is that there's a possibility. It's not likely, it's a remote possibility, but there's a possibility they will never stop up that well, and it will destroy the ocean. And in the process, it will destroy the world as we know it. I mean, that is a possibility. While we're all worried about, you know, whether Iran has nuclear weapons or whether we might destroy the world with nuclear war, what we've also got to understand is that we have technologies that the oil companies are using that they don't have any control over that are just as dangerous. And I think we must recognize that. And I also think we need to recognize that this is not rare. It's unusual, but there's a Texaco, now owned by Chevron, dumped much more toxic waste into the forest of Ecuador than so far have gone into the Gulf from BP. And none of us have heard of that. And that was not an accident. Texaco did it on purpose. There's a huge lawsuit, $27 billion lawsuit filed against Texaco by 30,000 indigenous people in the Ecuadorian Amazon for what they did intentionally as part of their policy. It's gone on in Africa. It's gone on throughout Asia. Similar things, maybe not quite of this magnitude, but huge, terrible oil spills. And yet we in the United States don't pay much attention to those. So I think, James, and this is probably, I have to be careful how I say this. It may irritate some of your listeners. But if we had to have an oil spill like this, I think we ought to feel blessed that it happened off our shores because we are the largest consumer of oil. We're the most powerful, wealthiest nation on earth, and we're the biggest consumer of oil. So we need to understand the implications, and I hope we won't just shut down offshore drilling and take this terrible catastrophe to the Amazon or the deserts of Arabia or the forests of Indonesia. I think we need to understand that this is a message not to stop offshore oiling, but to get off oil, to reduce our dependency right away, to stop it, and to stop giving such power to these oil companies. We need to get the true global message of this, not just the short-term localized message.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Now, as you've seen, I mean, I've looked at your website, and there's been a lot of talk about what the Fed is doing, how that we need to audit the Fed, that none of those people are saying exactly where all the trillions of money are missing. And what's interesting to me is, like, if anybody out there listening missed a payment or was late on a payment or anything in their personal lives, there would be hell to pay for that. They pay interest, finance charges, and they become enslaved by the banks and so forth, or whatever, whether it's credit cards or mortgages or whatever. And the whole thing, everybody's saying, you know, we need to audit the Fed. What do you think is the answer for the, you know, proper economic model for the U.S. to get out of this situation, if they're even going to get out of it the way it is now?
Well, first of all, I'd have to say, in the long run, we need to get rid of the Fed. This is a terrible monetary system that we have. You know, our currency that's based on debt and a private organization like the Fed controlling it, we need to get rid of the Fed. I'm not sure that that's going to happen in the short term. There's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of powerful forces. The four presidents that opposed the Fed were all assassinated, incidentally, Kennedy being the most recent, Garfield and McKinley. Lincoln, the only one that ever stood up against the central bank in the United States and survived was Andrew Jackson. That was a hell of a long time ago. We need to get rid of the Fed, but in the short term, of course it needs to be audited. It needs to have much stricter controls placed on it. There's no question about it. The Fed is a demonic institution and one that serves the very rich.
Absolutely. You know, Ron Paul has been talking, and there's big campaigns to end the Fed, end the Fed. Do you think, for this particular situation, the power is with the people on this, or is it going to have to be done on the top level with the senators and, you know, Congress people and all that going through those channels? Or is there going to be a chance for the public to do anything on this level?
We have to do it. The public has to do it, or it won't happen. And that's been the case throughout history, as I pointed out before. You know, we've got to take up arms, basically, and I don't mean we have to, you know, run out into the streets with AK-47s, but we have to really get our voices known. And in this day and age, with the Internet as it is, it's easier for us to do that. We really must do this. We must let corporations know. We must let the government know that we're going to get rid of these terrible organizations. You know, the hypocrisy of our government and our system and the verbiage that goes along with it is outrageous. For example, you know, when we hear people talking against Social Security or universal health care or Medicare, I'm so struck. I was talking the other day with a retired admiral, Navy admiral, and we were talking about this, and we were talking about the idea of quote-unquote socialized medicine, universal health care. And he said, well, the military has socialized medicine. He said, I don't understand socialization is a bad word in this country if any politicians dares use it. But the fact of the matter is the military is highly socialized. We get incredible pensions. We get great health care. We don't get the best pay in the world, but we get incredible socialized services. And he said, and on top of that, so does the U.S. Congress. The senators and the people in the House of Representatives have socialized insurance, health care, medicine, everything. So how do we get this that the people aren't allowed to have these things? And when we attach these words like socialized medicine, which provokes images of Stalin, and yet it's not about that at all. Our military is highly socialized. Our Congress is highly socialized. Our whole governmental system is highly socialized. The only people that aren't benefiting from these sorts of things are the majority of us who don't work for the government or the military or the House of Representatives or the Senate or the White House. They don't get it.
Right, right. You know, when you're talking to people, military brass on that level, where do they see the infrastructure of the military-industrial complex with banking? Because war is, it's business, you know. So where do they, I mean, have you had people on high levels like that say, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I've had enough. I found out that this whole thing, this game is rigged, and I want out. Have you had people that happen for you?
Yes, I have. But, you know, like anywhere else, there's a lot of different individuals out there. And there's some of them that say that they're in there because they want to change the system from the inside. They don't see any way that they can do it otherwise. There's other people who, you know, come from certain backgrounds that say, well, you know, I know it's an imperfect system. I don't like the fact we're supporting the Federal Reserve. But on the other hand, I don't want my children to grow up in a Muslim dictatorship. I hear that. And then, of course, there's other ones who say, then there's other ones that say, I love this system. You know, we certainly have people in the military that are saying, you know, I'm all for it. I'm part of the military-industrial complex. And basically, they don't say it quite like this, but basically where they're coming from is they're saying, geez, as soon as I retire from being a general or an admiral, I'll become CEO of a major corporation or a big bank. And I like that idea. So, you know, it's like anywhere else. You get lots of individuals that think in very different ways.
Interesting. You know, I've had lots of people that I've interviewed here, you know, that said their take on the particular situation with the banks and what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? There's a general waking up of the U.S., I feel. When you go to other parts of the world, what is the take on, like, for instance, when you're in South America, what's the take on the status of America and what they've done? Do they like Americans? Do they see, is it a big mess from the top down? Or we've failed as a public to control our misleaders who have put us into this situation? What's the attitude that you come across?
Yeah, it's interesting. I speak Spanish fluently, and so when I go to Latin America, I spend a lot of time just talking to people in the streets of La Paz or Quito or wherever I happen to be. And I'm always fascinated how people that we would consider illiterate peasants who can barely read seem to know a lot more about what's going on internationally than people in this country who have MBAs or PhDs. It's shocking to me sometimes, James, how uneducated our highly educated people are, how propagandized we are in this country. And that's not true in many other countries, and I'm sure it is in some countries, but especially right now in Latin America, where you really have a revolution going on, where 10 countries in recent elections have voted in very enlightened presidents who are saying no more exploitation by foreign corporations. I mean, something phenomenal is going on in Latin America. And it seems to me that people there are much better educated, and I'm not talking about reading, writing, and arithmetic. I'm talking about realizing what's going on in the world. They know the glaciers are melting. They know their rainforests are being destroyed by oil. They know we've got to change. They know the United States is taking a very, very imperialistic role around the world. Many of our own people, even highly educated ones, do not accept that or we're in denial about it. But again, I do believe this is changing. I think we're becoming more educated in the United States. I think programs like yours are helping. Books like mine and all the television, radio, movies that are coming out now are helping to change things.
So you know, I looked at your website and I've read the book. It's so interesting because I was actually in Iquitos when I was reading your book, and I said, "Look, this is a guy that really has done a number." I love that you've come out and you've called it out on everybody. I think that's fantastic. But I also was interested in your take on, you know, when Avatar came out, that hit home. I mean, the biggest grossing movie of all time. When you saw that, did they have a personal feelings toward that? Because, you know, it's the big business comes in and just takes and takes and takes and doesn't have any, you know, sustenance or sensitivity to the environment. It's all money and it's all greed. When you saw that, I mean, you must have referenced that a lot after you saw it, right?
I did, and you know, it's interesting because I was going around the country at that time, just before it came out, talking about how the system we've created is a failure. Our current economic system, not just because of the recession that we're having, but when you consider that less than 5% of us live in the United States and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources, you realize this is a failed system because it can't be replicated. It isn't a model. You can't replicate that in South America or Africa. And I would say this. I'd say you'd need another 5 planets without any human beings, but with all of our resources in order to replicate that. If a fifth of the world consumed 30%, you do the math. You need another 5 planets. And I was saying this. And, of course, that movie is really about that. It's saying, you know, we got to go to another planet and exploit their minerals in order to survive here on this planet. And then you've got these people who are entities who are very enlightened and are able to connect themselves with the trees and with the animals on this deep basis, this non-verbal basis, which is, as you know, not dissimilar to how native Amazonian people live today and have lived, and native North Americans did in the past. So it was a very wonderful, wonderful movie from that standpoint. I guess, you know, what bothered me about it was, once again, it was kind of like the white guy, the Marine or Special Forces, whatever he was, comes in to sort of save the day, and they ultimately do it themselves, but he has to lead the way, which I thought was a little bit unfortunate.
Right. But it's interesting. The part that was interesting to me is because, you know, I brought that up because you were a guy that was working for the bad guys and you did a transformation totally, which means if you can do it, other people can do it as well. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And I hear this all the time. You know, a year or so ago, I dropped in on the World Bank bookstore in Washington, D.C., and I was shocked to see my book up on a shelf with the 10 bestsellers.
Wait a minute. At the World Bank bookstore, they have your book?
Yes, and I asked to speak with the manager. He came out and I said, you know, I'm the author of that book. Do you want to sign it? He said, oh, we'd love to have you sign it. I said, I'm surprised you even carry this book in this bookstore. And then it's one of your 10 bestsellers. He says, it's been one of our 10 bestsellers ever since it came out, like 4 years ago. And he said, if we'll carry anything that the people who work for the bank want. This is a bookstore that's exclusively for World Bank employees. And he said, they love this book. And I've spoken at the World Bank to their employees twice. And he said they love it. And I get a lot of emails from people from the World Bank and other such organizations, James, and they come up to me especially when I'm in Washington doing talks and book signings, and tell me, you know, keep this up. You're spreading the word. We want you to keep spreading the word.
Wait a minute. So you have your book published. They ask you to come speak at the World Bank, and you're basically saying, what are you guys doing here enabling this problematic situation? And they allow that. They want you there.
Well, officially the World Bank has not asked me to speak there. I've spoken to the United Nations. But I speak in Washington at bookstores and universities and at the Green Festival in Washington, where a lot of World Bank people come to hear me speak. I have not been officially invited to speak at the World Bank since the book came out. I was invited to speak there just before the book came out, actually, to a particular conference that was held there. But even though I'm not invited to speak at the World Bank, there people come to hear me speak at other venues in Washington, D.C.
And do they shortly thereafter resign from their positions? Has that occurred after they've met you?
You know, I had dinner one night with a bunch of young World Bank staffers. This was organized by a friend who does consulting work for the World Bank. There's a bunch of young people in the World Bank who want to meet you. It was not an official World Bank function. We had this marvelous dinner, a whole, I don't know, 50 or so. And they were asking me, the young people were saying, well, you know, we came to this bank as idealists. We came here to change the world, to get rid of poverty. And we're not doing it. And your book talks about that. And what should we do? And my response was, you know, change the bank. The bank's mission statement basically says to rid the world of poverty. And the bank was founded at the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of World War II to reconstruct a devastated Europe. And it did a pretty good job at that. Now the world's pretty devastated. We need somebody to reconstruct it. And I said to them, look, you know, insist that this bank does what its mission statement says. It's doing the opposite. Insist it. Insist it. Don't just, I mean, this is my suggestion. I say you can do what you want to do, but my suggestion is don't just quit your job and go off and do something else. Before you do that, go all out. Rock the boat within the bank. What are they going to do? Fire you? If they fire you, then you haven't lost anything because you want to get out anyway, and you can go out and make huge waves about how they fire you. You can even sue them for firing you for expressing your opinion. Rock the boat.
Wow, you know the art of war. Go from the inside out, huh?
Once you're in, don't go out whimpering, you know. If you're going to go out making waves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you know any guys that have done that have actually done make waves like that, let me know, because I'm their official cheerleader. Because that I think is one of the best ways of what you just mentioned there is educating these guys, find out, okay, these are the people you're really working for. And I want you to do something from the inside out. Don't just bail and leave and jump somewhere else, but do something from the inside out. Do you think that's that's effective? Or people at the very top, they don't listen. All right, you're out of here. You're fired. Get out of here.
People,
what do they do?
They'll do that. They'll just fire them. But first of all, they go through a whole HR, you know, human resources process, where they're invited in to have the talk. And the talk basically says, don't you know that what the bank does is taught in every major business school? And we realize that there's the shortcomings, that we're not doing everything perfectly, but we're really trying. We want you to get in there and try to. You're a brilliant young person. We hear you. And so get in there and try. Don't criticize us so loudly. If you're on the team, you've got to play for the team, and you can try to change it from within, but don't criticize us in public. We don't want our dirty laundry hung out there. So come on, we'll work with you. And they're seduced, and they're given a little promotion. Maybe they're sent on a lush assignment to you know, some beautiful place in the world where they've been dying to go all their life, and they fly first class and they stay in the best hotels. That's what happened to me. So there are these very subtle ways to bring someone around once they decide that they're going to make waves, and that's the toughie, the temptations that are there. And at the same time, you're being fed this line of crap that if you stay in, you'll be effective.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I when I initially was inside the World Bank, I was some of my blood relatives worked for the World Bank, and I went in to see my half brother, and he kept telling me, "Well, you know, I'm going here, and they fly first class here, and it sounded really flashy and really nice." And I was asking him, like, "Do you know who you're working for, man? I mean, what are you doing?" And he was like, "Well, what are you talking about?" I said, "No, you don't really know who you're working for." And I told him, and I don't know what happened after that. I don't think he's still there, but so it is possible once you kind of give somebody the real perspective. Because are you saying it from the when they initially get there, they're groomed into a certain position, and after they've been there 3 or 4 years, then they find out what they're really there for, or is it do they know what they're there for right away?
I think it's different for different people, and depending on what department they're in and where they're going. But remember, the grooming started long before they went there. The grooming started at Wharton or Cornell or Stanford or whatever MBA program they came out of or law school they came out of. That's where it really gets started. We really our education system is about teaching people to be cogs in the corporate world. That's really what it's about. And as I said earlier, it's shocking sometimes to me to find out that illiterate peasants in Brazil or Colombia know more than PhDs hear about what's really going on in the world, because our education system really dumbs us down to those kinds of things. And it's not just the college education. It's everything we see on television. It's Fox News. It's what you see in the airport where you walk through the airport and the news is on television. And, it's everywhere, James. And so it begins long before they ever get into the World Bank. And if they've reached this point where they're questioning and they've read a book like mine, they said, my God, I better question this, and then they go out and have dinner with me. They've crossed a huge threshold, but it's not that difficult a threshold for a clever HR person to bring them back across, because they basically they're enjoying their jobs, they get great salaries, they get great pensions, their kids, if they get kids and spouses, they're living in the best houses in Washington, you know, and sending their kids to the best schools. They've got good lives by all the standards that we tend to measure ourselves by. And right. I like to tell them that, you know, someday you're going to look back at this and realize you were miserable. It wasn't really that good a life. It just had all the trappings of a good life. But it takes time for people
exactly.
to get that. Where I was. I had all the trappings, but I was miserable, actually, when I was an economic hitman. I didn't realize I was miserable. I thought I was happy because all the trappings said I was happy. But the fact of the matter is I was living on Valium and alcohol, and I went through a terrible divorce and huge amounts of psychological therapy, and I was not happy, but I didn't even know I wasn't happy.
Oh, my God. Wow. You really do have a big story. I could ask you some other questions about what you were actually doing in the Andes and with some of the people down there. I won't, because I already know, and that's probably like a whole different section there. But I'm I want to know in the book you have, as I know, Hoodwinked. Let me just, because some people have just tuned in here. I'm speaking with John Perkins, author of Hoodwinked. You can go to him at johnperkins.org, Elisa in New Orleans. And there's a question on the board here from Beth in Oregon. She goes, hi, James. Hi, John. Would John share his thoughts on what is happening with unemployment and the feds pulling back on supplementing state funding? I am 4 years away from my Social Security. Will it be there?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball that can say whether it will be or not, but I will say I think we have to fight hard, and that your listener needs to get out there, get organized, do everything that I think it was a she can possibly do. And the Internet gives us tremendous opportunities here to do that. We must do it. We must protect Social Security. We must protect Medicare. We've got to go farther. We need to get more of that for us, ourselves, not just for our congresspeople and their military, but for all of us. So it will not be there if the corporatocracy has their way, or they'll privatize it more and more. You know, the big corporations always complain about having to pay for insurance, et cetera, et cetera. They're always cutting back. But the fact of the matter is they love the fact that they are the providers of insurance to most people, because it makes us dependent. You can't leave a corporation. And especially if you had cancer or some other debilitating illness, or one that's considered chronic or critical, you can't leave because you can't get insurance on your own. So you got to stay there. You're their slave. And they love that. We need to get this out of the hands of the corporations. We need universal health insurance in this country. We need more Social Security, not less, and we need to fight for it. And I'm not a socialist in terms of, you know, a Stalinist or a communist or something. I'm a capitalist. But I really feel that we need to take care of the basic needs of our people, and we need to do it in a way that's as fair as what the Congress thinks is fair for them.
Now, it seems to me, and I could be wrong, but I'm just based upon my own research, you have another book called The World as You Dream It, Teachings from the Andes and the Amazon. When you were down there, and I have not read that book, but I'm presuming that your transformation took place from what you were to who you are now, and part of the inspiration came from that book. Is that true to say?
Yeah, you know, that. So I was a Peace Corps volunteer in 1968 to 71 in the Amazon and the Andes, and I've been going back regularly ever since. I have three godchildren there. I work with a lot of shamans and indigenous people, and I think it's fair to say that that's given me a perspective that the world really is as we dream it. That we here in the north have had this dream of heavy industry, lots of cars, lots of material wealth, and the dreams come true because we've given it a lot of energy. And the shamans tell us that whatever we dream, if we give it energy, it will materialize. So that dream has materialized, and now we're discovering that it's basically a nightmare, and it's starting to destroy us. And so we need to redream. We need to come up with a new dream, which to me is a dream of being sustainable, having living in a world that's environmentally sustainable and socially just and peaceful, and to understand that my grandson, who's 2.5, can't expect to have such a world unless every child on the planet has that world. This wasn't true a few years ago, James. You know, you could take care of your city, you could take care of the United States, you could say that's all that really matters, it doesn't matter what happens south of the Rio Grande or north of the Canadian border or beyond the Atlantic or the Pacific, but that's not true anymore. Today we really are a very fragile species living on a tiny planet. We're all sharing the same crises today, the crises of global warming, of resources diminishing at accelerating rates, and prices of food and fuels and other essentials increasing at accelerating rates, overpopulation, species extinction, violence due to desperation. We're all confronted by these same problems. Every human being on this planet, and for the first time in human history, we're all talking to each other through the Internet and cell phones. We're all communicating. So we're in a very unique position from a historical standpoint. And it's time we really understood this and understood our interdependency, and that we've all got to pull together and work to creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. And the shamans tell us that the world is as we dream it, that we can do this. We have to have a change of consciousness, and we have to give this new consciousness energy.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Hey, I work with them down there, and it was actually right after I was dealing with them. I was in deep, deep, deep in the jungle when nobody was around, and I was in a small group of people, and your book was there. And I got to tell you, from the people that passed it around after we had been working with the shaman, they all were asking, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Because all of them became instant, not only fans of the book, but I'd figure out that if a guy on this type of level, way at the highest, at working for the banks on that level, could go through a transformation, that means everybody else can as well. And it gave a lot of people hope. It gave a lot of people motivation. And as you have you gone on and continue writing books, and you know your recent one, Hoodwinked, by the way, everybody, Hoodwinked, if you want to pick up a copy of that, please go to Amazon.com or go to his website, johnperkins.org. As you've continued on publicizing this book, are a lot of people asking you, going, saying, what in the world are we doing in Afghanistan? What is the purpose really going on there? Is it because of a mineral source? Is it because of something else that's going on there? What's your take on that?
Well, certainly the mineral source, and this is news to a lot of us, but it certainly isn't news to the big corporations. They've known for a long time that all those minerals were there. That's certainly a motivating factor, no question about it. Oil and gas and other minerals, and the strategic location of Afghanistan has been important for a long time. The Russians, of course, wanted to take control of it. But then I think perhaps the biggest factor of all is that we're a war-based economy. We mm-hmm. have to keep going to war. And that's the other thing and I talk about in Hoodwinked. That's one of the other five areas. I talked about one area earlier, consumers and the fact that the marketplace is democratic. Another area is we need to change our economy. We're very war-based today, and so we have to keep going to war at different places. And Afghanistan was the logical next place after Iraq. And so we, the people, need to force these corporations out of that. I was recently in Nicaragua, James, and I was down there with a group of philanthropic investors, people who'd made some money in this country, wanted to help campesinos in Nicaragua develop organic farms and sell to Whole Foods up here and other organic outlets. But we mm-hmm. discovered that a lot of the land of Nicaragua, the agricultural land, has been destroyed by Dole and Chiquita, Kraft, Cargill, the big agribusinesses, and it can't be farmed organically. And we also discovered these huge lakes in Nicaragua, two lakes you can't see across. Nicaragua is endowed with wonderful water resources. They're terribly polluted to a large degree by our industries. And I thought at the time, what if we diverted a bunch of our military budget, or some percentage of the military budget, and we could pay the same companies. It would be nice to encourage entrepreneurs, but we could also encourage the companies that are currently building weapons, General Dynamics and General Motors and General Electric, the other generals, mm-hmm. Raytheon, et cetera. What if we hired them to, instead of building missiles and tanks, to come up with technologies to clean up the terribly polluted lands of Nicaragua and every other country on the planet, including our own, the polluted waters, the polluted airs? And what if we gave a percentage of our military budget to Cargill and Kraft and Dole to come up with technologies to help starving people in Africa grow food more efficiently and store it in local systems and distribute it through local means and in efficient ways? I think there's a whole new economy out there just waiting to happen, and we really need to turn this thing around and get out of the military business. But right now we're so committed to the military that going to war is what keeps our economy healthy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know it's sad that it's true that it's a sad truth. However, here's a thing I've been talking about on the air for quite some time, and that is alternative energy issues. And I know you were a CEO of a company that was dealing with that. I talk frequently here and interviewed some of the top people in the world having to do with cold fusion. What's your take on cold fusion?
Technologically speaking, I don't know much about it. I was CEO of an energy company, but I sold that company in 1990. It's been a long time, and I haven't kept up on it. But I will say that I think ultimately what we have to do is cut back on energy use. We have to become much more efficient, and we have to cut back. And I don't care whether we're looking at solar or wind or coal fusion or whatever we're looking at as an alternative, all of them will have problems if they become massive. So if you considered replacing all the fossil fuel plants in this country today with wind, for example, you'd impact the climate. Wind machines affect climate. And they kill a lot of bats and eagles, too, incidentally. Or if you replace them all with solar, big solar units, and certainly every roof should have solar panels, and I'm all for that. But if we were really to replace the central generating units of this country, the fossil-fired units or the nuclear units with solar, we would certainly impact the Earth and the environment, too, because that sun energy, instead of going into the Earth, instead of going into plants, instead of going into the air, would be used to boil water to create electricity. And the simple laws of physics tell us that when you use energy for one thing, it isn't available for other things. So we really need to recognize that the technology is not going to buy us out of this. We've got to bite the bullet at some point and realize that we've just got to use less and use it more efficiently.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Hey, listen, I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time of doing this. It's been a long time, I would say about 6 years since I first saw your book, and I've been waiting to talk to you for a long time. Everybody, you're listening to John Perkins talk about his book, Hoodwinked. It's available on his website, johnperkins.org. It's also available on amazon.com. Also, you'd be smart to not only get Hoodwinked, but get Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I'm telling you, because this is a guy who's been on the inside, he's completely transformed, he's going around saying the message that I've been saying for a long time. So, John, I want to thank you very, very much, and let you know also I'll be contacting you by email to give you a couple of important messages there as well. So I thank you very, very much for taking the time.
Well, you're welcome, James, and thanks for all the good work you're doing. And again, I would encourage you to go to johnperkins.org. Come to one of my events. I'm going to be in Vancouver soon and Massachusetts and New York and all over, so I'd love to meet some of your listeners in person.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you very, very much. Much appreciated.
Likewise. Bye.
All right, take care now. All right, everybody, this is johnperkins.org. Okay, everybody, I've talked to you over and over again about the necessary, you got to get yourself briefed on what you're dealing with. I know all of you out there are dealing with some kind of bank issue. All of you are having deep financial issues. That the mentality at the very top, as you just heard, it's been socially conditioned into people from the moment they've gotten into college, at the business schools and so forth. They're not apt to see outside of their own immediate environment. They're not thinking holographically. They're not thinking, you know, I'm going to work for an institution that's going to affect people in other parts of the world, especially in agriculture parts of the world, that are going to affect the entire infrastructure of nature, the whole thing. And if there's a guy that knows, this is the guy. Always, please go to johnperkins.org. I know he's going to be speaking throughout the country. This is a gentleman that's a great asset for the future of not only speaking on behalf of some of the indigenous cultures like in Peru and Nicaragua, as you heard him say, all over the place. This is a guy that knows and's got the experience. Now, I want to add on to that a special announcement as well to let you know that we are having on the 20th of July, we're going to have media ecologist Chad Scoville on. And then on the 22nd, we're having David Cobb return, presidential candidate for the Green Party, David Cobb, 2004. He's a big guy on getting rid of the corporations, everybody. And special guest, tentatively, on the 27th of July, we're having Jeremy Gilley, who is the gentleman who put together peaceoneday.org. He's met everybody. He's very well known in Europe. I just got off the phone this morning at his office, and he's completing a film. He's the guy that basically set up One Day all over the world where there's peace and there's no war going on with anywhere. So peaceoneday.org, we're going to be having him on July 27th. You're not going to want to miss that. So I want to thank, again, John Perkins for taking the time out today. Much appreciated. And again, everybody, if you're having issues with your credit card, foreclosure issues, please email me at getdebtreliefnow@gmail.com, or you may call me at 888-213-7655. Thanks again for your support. Again, go to johnperkins.org. His new book is Hoodwinked. It is on amazon.com. He's got a bunch of interesting information on there as well. I highly recommend you check out all his books. He's done a great, great job, and I'm glad he took the time out to do this today. So much appreciated to him. And obviously, we will see all of you again next week. Do the right thing, everybody. Remember, the answer's inside of you. It's up to you to make these changes. You can't rely on everybody else. You're going to have to do it yourself. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot, everybody. This is James Martinez with Cash Flow. You take care now. It makes you want to sing. It's such a beautiful thing. You change. Lots of diamond rings. The happiness it brings. You live like a king. With lots of money and things. Can you hear it ring? It makes you want to sing. You live like a king. With lots of money and things.
Ka-ching. I'm finding it hard to resist.
AchieveRadio.com.
So show me what I'm looking for.
Hello, everybody. This is James Martinez from The Cash Flow Show. The great poet Robert Frost once said, quote, "A bank is a place where they lend you an umbrella in fair weather and ask for it back when it begins to rain." End quote. I'd like to show you how you can take back your power and your financial freedom. You may be already aware of your inherent need to create your own financial future rather than someone else deciding for you. In the days ahead, you'll be faced with more and more financial duress unless you take action and take your power back. If you've been faced with substantial alleged credit card debt or foreclosure, call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. You may begin to know that it's time. Time to begin to imagine a life where you know your true value isn't working for a bank, rather making your bank work for you. Invoke your desires and make it so. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655.